like all Muslims around the world.
Eid celebrations in the besieged Gaza Strip will undoubtedly fall short of being full due to the ongoing Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Russia's tensions with the West are threatening to quickly spiral out of control as the war in Ukraine drags on. Immediately after the start of the conflict on February 24th, the US and its allies rushed to the aid of Ukraine. They've imposed sweeping sanctions against Moscow and provided Kiev with military and humanitarian assistance. The size of those shipments and sophistications of the weaponry have been increasingly growing. Besides that, US State and Defense Secretaries recently traveled to Ukraine, promising more military aid.
They need long-range fires. You've heard them express a need for tanks. And we are doing everything that we can to get them the types of support, the types of artillery and munitions that will be effective in this stage of the fight. We're going to push as hard as we can, as quickly as we can, to get them what they need.
What I'm seeing, at least, is that aid is getting here and other distribution points. It's getting out the door incredibly quickly.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is the latest U.S. official to travel to Kiev. There, she promised Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky that more help is on the way. Pelosi was referring to a request by President Joe Biden from Congress to pass an aid package to Ukraine. The package is worth $33 billion, with almost two-thirds of it allocated to military aid. That aid includes everything from heavy artillery and armored vehicles to greater intelligence sharing, cyber warfare tools, as well as anti-tank and anti-aircraft missiles. Meanwhile, French President Emmanuel Macron, in a phone call with Zelensky, said Paris would step up military and humanitarian support to Ukraine. Those measures by the US and its allies have prompted strong warnings and criticism from Moscow. Russia says the military aid is not only fueling the conflict, but also boosting the risk of direct confrontation between Russia and NATO powers.
The tendency itself to pump weapons, including heavy weapons, to Ukraine and other countries is an action that threatens the security of the continent and provokes instability.
Yet more starkly, the Russian foreign minister has warned that the conflict in Ukraine risks escalating into a third world war. Sergei Lavrov says NATO is in essence engaged in a proxy war with Moscow by supplying Kiev with weapons. He has urged the US and NATO to stop sending weapons if they really want to resolve the Ukraine crisis. On the ground in Ukraine, Russia has been targeting foreign weapons. In the latest such move, Moscow says it struck weapons shipments supplied by the US and European countries on an airfield near the southern port city of Odessa. In another sign of escalation, Moscow says dialogue between Russia and the US on strategic stability has been formally frozen. And so as Russia's warnings go unheeded in the West, there's a real risk that the war will spill across Ukraine's borders before it comes to a peaceful resolution inside.
For the first time since the presidential election, the Yellow Vests marched around the country. And most expressed disbelief that Emmanuel Macron was re-elected despite his unprecedented repression of the group.
Frankly, we really don't understand how Macron could be re-elected. We started over purchasing power, and it's worse than ever. I guess people need a knife to their throats to come protest anymore?
They were met by a huge police presence, armed to the teeth. The government continues to intimidate Yellow Vests, but also the average person from rejoining the demonstrations. Intimidating deterrence is also being used to keep journalists from covering the group. In the Yellow Vest demonstration the day before the first round of voting, a journalist from a top French media was fined for allegedly illegally demonstrating while simply reporting on the Yellow Vests.
We'll never stop demanding for citizens' referendums, purchasing power, decent pensions and the ability to have some money left at the end of the month. After the legislative elections in June and the summer vacation, social unrest will explode this fall.
Thousands of devoted Yellow Vests will continue to turn out every Saturday in Paris alone. And they say others will put their Yellow Vests back on when they see Macron's plans for his second term.
Emmanuel Macron will continue to be the president of the rich and will continue to march. People will eventually recover their good sense and realize the only way to change politics is to join us in the streets.
Nobody expected the Yellow Vests to stop marching. Now we'll see if they can last for the next 5 years.
Global May Day protests will see establishment forces, such as unions and political parties, march nationwide in favor of workers' rights, but also to express major dissatisfaction with the presidential election. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
As the month of Ramadan is coming to an end, Muslims are gearing up to pick the best clothes to get dressed up for one of their biggest festivities, Eid al-Fitr, or the Festival of Breakfast. This exhibition gives a glimpse of local costumes of several Muslim countries, from Tunisia and Egypt, all the way to Afghanistan and Iran.
On Eid al-Fitr and other important festivities in Tunisia, men wear this white costume, and women dress like me or the clothes that you see behind me. They are our traditional clothes.
The shirt this man is wearing is made from a Syrian cloth called the maska. It's a famous Syrian cloth that's made out of silk and cotton. Syrian men wear them in celebrations such as weddings and also during our festivities such as Eid al-Fitr.
Aside from showcasing their costumes, the participating nations also get to introduce their Ramadan traditions and what they have for iftar breakfast.
In Syria, it's customary to break our Ramadan fast with our traditional appetizers such as fattoush and tabbouleh. In my city, Aleppo, we start with dairy such as hot milk. Afterwards, we eat the main dish, which varies from a city to the other.
In Afghanistan, we cook our delicious gulani and ashak for Ramadan breakfast. These foods actually are cooked for our dearest guests in other months of the year.
Organized jointly by Iran's Echo Office and the Culture Ministry, the event seeks to bring about a stronger bond between Muslim nations by sharing their cultures and traditions.
Here, Muslims get together to find their commonalities and at the same time learn about their differences. The expo also brought exhibitors coming from ECO member states. The reason we held it in the holy month of Ramadan is to say that despite all our differences, all of us are Muslims and need to unite.
Muslims say Ramadan brings them together more than any other time, since they all practice the same religious tasks throughout the month. And as the call to prayers resonated in the exhibition, all fasting Muslims left the expo for a shared iftar breakfast.
Despite all the differences in languages, costumes, and even Ramadan meals, people here say they feel like they're one nation, since they all come from Muslim countries. And organizers say this is what Ramadan offers, a taste of peace and friendship that transcends all differences. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Afghanistan, once again facing waves of deadly attacks. In the latest incident, a powerful explosion hit Khalifa Sahib Mosque in the capital Kabul, killing and injuring dozens of worshippers.
Every Friday, people come to the mosque to say their prayers. Hearing the bomb explosion, I entered the mosque. I am shocked as I'm talking. We took more than 200 casualties to the hospital. It was so horrifying that I had never witnessed such a scene.
Previously, we were falling victim to the US and Taliban war. However, the situation has now changed, but we're still being killed in the mosques and schools. We don't know who are carrying out such blind attacks, but I'm sure the attackers are not Muslims.
Exhausted by growing violence, people of Afghanistan are calling for an end to terror attacks and punishment for the perpetrators.
In my opinion, the recent attacks on specific groups and places show that the enemies of the people of Afghanistan are trying to sow sedition among Muslims and impose another proxy war on Afghans. The Taliban, as new rulers, are obliged to protect Afghans and bring the terrorists to justice.
The international community should take action in ending violence in Afghanistan. They know the roots of terrorist groups or criminal bonds. They should help Afghans with practicing stability. If they are voicing human rights, so why they are watching us falling victim to terrorism?
In the recent days, several large bomb attacks targeted public places in the capital Kabul, Mazar-i-Sharif, and Kunduz provinces. The attacks have taken a scores of lives, mostly from the Hazara community. Bomb attacks in Afghanistan continue as Afghans are observing the holy month of Ramadan. People here believe their enemies are missing no chance to harm innocent Muslims. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The iftar table stretches for 5 kilometers. Organized by Tehran's Grand Bazaar, the event served iftar to over 5,000 people, mostly low-income families. Organizers say it is the longest iftar spread ever hosted in the world.
I'm honored to have the chance to host my fellow citizens for an iftar dinner. The Grand Bazaar of Tehran started this initiative with the aim of helping the less privileged. Throughout the year, we launch many charity initiatives, but its climax is in Ramadan, because it is the month of kindness.
This is the second time Tehran's Grand Bazaar hosts such a large-scale iftar meal as a charity gesture. The benefactors who contributed to the event say Ramadan is a time to push the limits on humanity and put a smile on the faces of the needy.
It's so beautiful when you see the rich and the poor sit around the same iftar spread and break their Ramadan fast. I'm so happy to be a part of this, and I hope such humanitarian gestures will be promoted to hopefully root out poverty.
Every year in Ramadan, charity works get supercharged, with Muslims trying to pitch in to have a say in helping the poor, as they believe Ramadan is not just about abstention from eating and drinking, but it's a time for sharing love and kindness with fellow human beings.
With all its beautiful celebrations like this large iftar party, Ramadan is about to come to an end. But organizers say what's important is to learn the lessons of Ramadan on the beauty of kindness and togetherness, which if practiced, the world would be a better place to live. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip rallied on Friday to mark International Quds Day. Millions of people around the world hold rallies every year to mark this day, which takes place on the last Friday of the holy Muslim month of Ramadan, to support the people of Palestine. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and demanded an end to the Israeli occupation. The big event was organized by the Islamic Jihad movement.
Today we mark International Quds Day, while freedom fighters from Gaza, Yemen, Tehran, Lebanon and Syria, as well as in other places around the world, stand united for the sake of Al-Quds.
International Quds Day was declared in 1979 by the founder of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, the late Ayatollah Khomeini, to drum up international solidarity for the Palestinian people. People at the rally expressed their gratitude to Imam Khomeini for his historic initiative.
On International Quds Day, we say to the whole world that we are willing to sacrifice our lives for the sake of Al-Quds. We also want to express our deepest gratitude to the Islamic Republic of Iran and Imam Khomeini for this important occasion in solidarity with Al-Quds.
Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque have a special place in the hearts of millions of Muslims around the world due to its religious status. Extremist Jewish settlers backed by Israeli forces have been violating the sanctity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in recent days.
Imam Khomeini's designation of this day is of great importance because it unites all resistance fronts for the sake of supporting Palestine and Al-Quds. These fronts are united today more than ever to help secure the liberation of Al-Quds.
International Quds Day is observed in over 80 countries around the globe.
Observers say the international community has failed to help the Palestinians and has turned a blind eye to the Israeli violations against them for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah held a rally to commemorate International Quds Day. Secretary General of the resistance movement Sayed Hassan Nasrallah addressed the gathering, stressing that the latest individual operations by Palestinians have once again shown the weakness of the Israeli regime, while proving that the Palestinian people have not forgotten their cause, but have rather become more hopeful in the liberation of their land.
The Palestinians told the Israelis over the past weeks that they cannot occupy Palestine and still enjoy security. The military confrontations have proven to be capable of achieving victories and defeating the enemy, and this path must continue. Liberating Palestine might not need great armies or weapons, but rather martyrdom fighters.
Said Nasrallah also warned the Israelis that any uncalculated move during their military drills in May will lead to a direct retaliation from Hezbollah.
When the Israeli exercises begin, the resistance in Lebanon will be at the highest levels of alert and readiness. We tell the Israeli enemy not to bet on exhaustion or hunger or poverty. Any act of foolishness will be met with an immediate response.
The leader of the resistance in Lebanon once more reiterated the regional strategy that any assault on Al-Quds will lead to a regional war. Palestinians in Lebanon also attended the rally in Beirut and held several gatherings in refugee camps. They also were vocal in asserting that they are with the pro-armed struggle.
We tell our people, the youth of Al-Quds, where 250,000 have gathered to fortify and defend this holy site. They are defending the dignity of the entire nation. Today, we are commemorating this day not only in solidarity, but we are commemorating with the sword of Al-Quds. We are the children of the sword. We are the sons of the resistance and the front of the resistance. And with resistance, we shall liberate Al-Quds and defend human dignity.
Despite being away from their homeland, Palestinian refugees said their hearts and minds are with their people. International Quds Day is seen by many across the globe as a day to denounce Israeli oppression and occupation of Palestinian land. For Palestinians in the diaspora, it is a day to renew their decades-long struggle to return to their homeland. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی
In the path of the Imam
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, you heard on Imam Khomeini's struggles against the despotic regime of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, especially his opposition to the so-called White Revolution, which was a plan to legitimize the Shah rule. This time, we are going to dwell upon the events which led to the Imam's arrest in 1963. As you know, we have tried to quote from Imam Khomeini's venerated wife, Lady Khadija Saghafi, who was truly a fellow combatant beside the Imam. Stay with us, please. Imam Khomeini's opposition to the ceremonial referendum of the Shah awakened political groups and they accompanied the Imam in the struggles. But the regime announced that the referendum was successful and most of the people voted for it. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, at the threshold of the Iranian calendar year 1342, corresponding with March 1963, announced a public mourning. The Imam said, I announce this feast, Nowruz, as mourning for the Muslim community in order to make Muslims aware of the dangers ahead of the Quran and the country. The Imam had smartly announced that Nowruz as mourning day not due to the martyrdom of Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, the 16th infallible successor of the Prophet of Islam, but rather for the conspiracy of colonialists against Islam and the Quran. He said in a speech on the last day of Isfand 1342, corresponding with 1963, This year we have no feast, and I announce this feast as a public mourning, not because of coincidence with the martyrdom of Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, who has a lofty status, but due to the disasters and losses that have been inflicted on Islam. This year was not a happy year for Muslims. In this year, colonialism schemed plots against Islam. The wicked agents of colonialism insulted the Quran. They designed plans to violate the luminous laws of the Quran. They designed schemes and have plots in mind. If Muslims know what plots and designs are underway against the dignity of Islam, the happiness of Muslim nations and independence of Islamic countries, they will never mark feast. The announcement of public mourning by Imam Khomeini moved the entire Iranian nation. On the 2nd of Farvardin, the agents of Shah regime intended to disturb the ceremony held at Imam Khomeini's home on the occasion of Imam Sadiq's martyrdom, but they failed. Then, the security agents of the regime assaulted Faizia school in Qom and massacred many seminary students and mourners of Imam Sadiq to cause fear among the public, particularly ulema. However, Imam Khomeini called on people to be resistant and help the injured. The news of the bloody events soon spread to the whole country, and preachers took stances against the brutal regime. Nearly 2 months later, the atmosphere of the country was zealous and inspired by Imam Hussein's epic as Ashura was approaching. Imam Khomeini called on preachers and ulema to expose the Shah's servility to the U.S. and Israel and the dangers of this puppet regime for Islam and Muslims. Thus, people in Tehran held demonstrations in Tehran on the day of Ashura, and many of them, and the near cities, went to Qom to hear the imam's speech. On that day, Imam Khomeini delivered his historical speech in which he directly addressed the Shah. He said, "Oh, Mr. Shah, I advise you to give up these acts. You are being fooled. I don't like to see everyone giving thanks on the day that you are leaving the country. Do not play this much with the nation. Do not be this much opposed to ulema. Take admonition from your father. Listen to the ulema of religion as they like good for you. By God, Israel has no use for you." The speech of Imam Khomeini against the Shah horrified the regime, and on the following day, some of preachers and people attending the speech were arrested. At midnight, the imam's house was assaulted and he was arrested. Imam Khomeini's wife relates, "These events continued from the beginning of Muharram till Ashura, leading to that speech. And the next night they came and Ruhollah Khomeini was arrested. The imam had got up for midnight prayer. From the noise, he understood that what was going. It was 2:30 at midnight. The imam came to me and said, 'They have come to take me. Don't be upset and make no noise. Awaken others and tell them to be calm.' He was speaking so calmly that he insinuated calm in me. He was telling these words while I could hear the fast and worried gasps of the dastards behind the door of the house. They seemed to be 300 to 400, but there were more on the main street. There, they changed the imam's car and transferred him from a Volkswagen to a Mercedes. The imam, seeing the street full of agents, told the one beside him, 'So many people have come to take one?'"
Mm-hmm.
Imam Khomeini's wife continues on the night that the Imam was arrested by the agents of the regime. The sound of gasps became faster. The Imam left me to put on clothes. I was worried, but I awakened the children calmly, telling them that the strangers wanted to enter the house. Everyone woke up, but no one said anything. Everyone was listening to me. Suddenly, the door of our house was open with a kick, and there was a row. I called on everyone to be quiet and didn't let anybody defy the orders as the Imam had asked so. The Imam's shout disturbed the calm in the house as he said, "What's up? Why are you making so much noise? Our neighbors are asleep. Do not disturb them." At that moment, the door was broken and they poured into the house. They asked the Imam's whereabouts, and he pointed to his chest, saying with a sneer, "He is here," and said, "I am Khomeini. Do not bother anyone." The children wanted to shout, but I prevented them. The commander of the enemy asked, "Is it you?" The Imam said, "Yes, it is me. What do you want at this time of night?" Three people said in panic, "Please let us go." And they took the Imam. Mustafa asked the agents to take him too, but the Imam told him seriously, "Go back. Whom are you pleading?" After arresting Imam Khomeini, his family was sad, but his wife changed the climate. She says, "It was getting clear little by little. Our home, the home whose members had lost their father, source of emulation and leader, was interesting. Everyone was sitting stunned in a corner. Suddenly I said, 'Stand up. It is the time of prayer.' And that morning we performed a nice prayer." Imam Khomeini's wife continues, "The Imam would relate that on the way he told them that he wanted to pray, but they didn't let. He told them, 'Stop for a few minutes so that we pray together and then we move.' They didn't permit. Upon my insistence, they just stopped and I stooped and touched the soil and performed tayammum. And I was forced to say my prayer in the car. Then, as I caught the sight of oil reserves of Qom, I said, 'All or many of the miseries of this country stem from oil.' They were so much impressed that one of them said, 'Sir, we will return you. We know that we are guilty, but returning is equal to being shot dead.' He was not saying these words for flattery, but he was rather speaking sincerely as he wept."
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This one lay. Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to European countries stating that they will cut off their purchase of Russian oil and gas, that has not come to fruition. There are at least 10 countries that have continued to not only purchase their energy needs from Russia, but have also complied with the Russian demand that it be paid in rubles, even though the EU has banned member countries from doing so. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at how the EU, led by the U.S., is willing to sacrifice its economy and its people in order to sanction Russia with no real substitute strategy in place. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Harley Schlanger, spokesman for La Ruche organization, joins us from Potsdam, Germany. Also joining us, Paolo Raffone, Secretary General at SIPPI Foundation, who joins us from Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Harley Schlanger, let me first start with you. Let's first look at the Russian demand for rubles. It's going great, according to what we're seeing. Russia's ruble, the currency, is the most profitable currency, as it's been reported, for the month of March. And, of course, this comes after the U.S. said that it's just going to tank, and people said the ruble is going to turn into rubble. What do you attribute that to?
Well, there are two basic points. The first is that the Russian ruble is backed by something real, unlike the dollar, the pound, the euro, which are backed by printing presses. The ruble is backed by the physical economy of Russia. For one, Russia has a lot of gold, but they also produce wheat. They produce strategic metals. They produce timber. And so when countries trade in rubles, they are getting something that has some intrinsic value beyond just the paper money. At this point, the dollar, the only value of the dollar is the insistence of the U.S. that it's backing up the dollar by the United States economy, which is actually the economy that's tanking. So on the one hand, the Russian ruble is relatively stable. As you pointed out, it's back at its pre-war level after it had really gone down for a while. And it was a very clever move by President Putin to protect the Russian economy, to demand that the gas payments and oil payments be made in rubles.
Okay, let's take a look at the stance of the EU, the European Commission. Paolo Raffone has made a statement saying that it has no information that any European company has paid in rubles for Russian gas. Do you find that a bit odd that they would have no information when there are at least 10 European countries who have continued their purchases?
Well, officially, no country has acknowledged that they paid in ruble. Probably it is happening, but behind the curtains. And this is because of the enormous pressure that the United States has put on the European authorities that did not authorize any of the member states to do so. So what will happen, I cannot predict, but I may say that there is a certain difficulty among the member states because of the impact that sanctions are having on the already weakened weakened economic perspective. So if we go on like this by the summer, it would be really economically catastrophic, and the winter to come will be socially unmanageable. So that's why probably behind closed doors and behind the curtains, something is happening but cannot be acknowledged.
So behind closed doors, our guest there, Harley Schlanger, says that the purchases are being made. And from what I understood from Paolo Raffone, it is the U.S. that's pressuring the EU countries. What is it that the U.S. is doing to pressure these countries that they have to come out? I'm not going to use the word lie, but they have to come out and paraphrase maybe or say an alternate explanation. What type of pressure is the U.S. exerting on them, if you agree with our guests there from Brussels?
Well, first of all, one thing that I can confirm is that there are 10 European companies which are in the gas, oil and gas business, which have opened accounts at the Gazprom Bank. Now, this is the demand that the Russians made. The way that you can do the trading is that you deposit dollars or euros or pounds in an account in the Gazprom Bank, and then they'll put rubles in an account that you also are holding there that can then be used to pay for oil and gas. So there are companies that have already done that, although they're not, haven't been named. Now, the pressure from the United States is enormous. And we saw that just last weekend with the meeting in Ramstein Air Base, where the German government, which up until April 22nd had insisted there would be no weapon shipments to Ukraine, suddenly reversed themselves. There's enormous pressure coming from the United States. On Germany, the Germans were told, if you don't go along with us, you'll be labeled an unreliable partner. And I think smaller countries are very much afraid that they'll be targeted for economic problems from the International Monetary Fund, from the banks. Many of these countries are facing payment crises coming up. And that's the leverage that the international banks out of London and Wall Street are holding over their heads.
So when you talk about that kind of pressure, are we talking about the fact that countries that may do business with Russia, even though they go the route of, for example, Gazprom Bank is where, I guess, the euros or dollars have to be deposited, turned into rubles, and then the purchase is made, that if they do that, that they're going to get pressured and maybe sanctioned because they're trying to make sure that their economy is going well, that it's sustainable, and that people are not starving or that they don't have to pay these enormous gas bills, that they're going to get penalized for that? This will be for Paolo Raffone.
Yeah, sure. I want to avoid that people take the streets, although already on the 1st of May we have seen a certain animosity in some of the streets across Europe. Things cannot go but worse if we do not stop this spiral of war in which Europe has nothing to do. Basically, we have been put into this war, which is technically taking place on European soil, but in fact is a war between the American perspective on the future of Europe and Eurasia and the Russian perspective on the same. So Europe is in between, and it has been summoned by the traditional ally, which is the United States, to follow suit in a war which is against Russia, which is practically a stupid move, because if something we should avoid is to have an enemy on our soil, which is Russia. So I see a very bleak future if we do not stop the war and we do not stop the sanctions. And we give a chance to peace, which means dialogue and find a solution, not arming people to defend themselves. This is not a way to calm the situation. And there will be no winner for a long time. So we risk to have a prolonged war, at different stages of warfare, but with no solution. And meanwhile, our economies will suffer and people too.
When you take a look at the statements, Harley Schlanger, that's coming out from the EU, is something that I want to point out and then get your reaction on, which are the inconsistencies in what they are saying. And not just on one occasion, two occasion, or three occasions, on more than that. For example, right before this emergency meeting that the EU ministers had, you had two European Union diplomats who said the bloc is leaning toward a ban on imports of Russian oil by the end of the year. Then you have a statement coming from the EU commissioner that said, well, if you do go ahead in a warning to the countries that are going to go ahead with purchasing Russian gas through that dual system, as they called it, I believe, that they will be breaking the sanctions. What is the EU position here? I mean, are we to believe that the EU actually is forthright in wanting to stop their ultimate goal, stop purchasing Russian gas and oil? Or are they just saying that, as you said, to see if some time can go by, perhaps there'll be some kind of solution to the conflict?
Well, it's very difficult to see that the EU has an actual goal. The European Union, in my view, is very dysfunctional. The goal is the goal of the British and the Americans to weaken Russia, as Defense Secretary Austin said at the Rammstein meeting, as Biden said. Biden basically said the goal is regime change. So the bigger issue here is whatever happens in Europe on oil and gas is not the concern of the United States or the British. They don't care if the populations in Europe suffer from a shortage of electricity, which is going to happen. They don't care if their own people suffer because gas prices in the United States are rising through the roof. Their goal is to destroy Russia, and there's a reason for it. The Russian ruble policy is part of a bigger policy, which is the beginning of a shift away from the petrodollar system. And the February 4th agreements between Russia and China signaled a willingness of these two countries to stop the blackmail that comes from the International Monetary Fund and Wall Street and the City of London. And there's support for Russia and China from many of the formerly non-aligned nations, former colonial nations who know how bad the European colonizers are. And so the problem is the Europeans are sort of collateral damage, just as the Ukrainian people are. The Ukrainian people are being used as a battering ram against Russia.
Well, Paolo Raffone, but isn't the U.S. shooting itself in the foot when it comes to the dollar? I mean, one of the biggest mistakes, as was said by a Citi monetary financial advisor, he said that the day that the U.S. and its partners confiscated Russian currency and deposits overseas, that was the alarm bell that went off, for example, for China, that they have their money overseas and they have reserves also in dollars, that they're going to start dumping the dollar. And of course, you, as you're well aware, this is going to set off these dollars that are going to come back to the U.S. and then perhaps the U.S. is going to be heading into hyperinflation. So in that respect, more importantly, the dollar is being risked. Is the U.S. willing to take that risk, which it seems like it is?
Well, this is a common practice of the United States. I mean, this is not the first time that they've been seizing national assets, but until when they were doing it for small countries or islands or, you know, inoffensive groups of enemies, it was feasible. This time they've been touching one of the five members of the Security Council. By the way, is the second or the first nuclear power in the world. And this changes completely the effect of what they have done, because evidently this is a breach of the Washington consensus, because Washington consensus is grounded on the trust that you have in the rules that govern the world currency, which is the dollar. But if those rules are then breached, and you decide to take away the assets of another country just because you esteem that it is your enemy, well, then the role of the dollar is into question. And we already see some reactions in China. They would like to avoid a currency war to the dollar, because the dollar in itself technically is working well as a currency. The thing is that it is managed by a state that is evil.
If it's doing well, then why is it that Israel is getting rid of some of its dollars? that has come out and said last week it's a liability. Why is Saudi Arabia doing the same and both opting for the yuan?
Sure, they do that because if you had your huge assets deposited in dollars anywhere in the world, the United States government can come and take them from overnight because they decided you're an enemy country for whatever reason they have.
Right.
And
okay.
This is not something that is a rule. It's arbitrary.
Let's move through the EU countries. Number one powerhouse, economic powerhouse, Germany. Harley Schlanger, I said I'm going to talk about inconsistencies, and here is one that goes flat or right in the face of the EU, coming from the German, I believe, Minister of Economy, Vice Chancellor and Economy Minister Robert Habeck. Whether an overall oil embargo is about to happen, I don't know. I'm hearing different things, and I'm talking to my colleagues about different things. Other countries are not there yet, and I believe that should be respected. What do you think?
Well, first of all, Habeck is a completely immoral character. He's a leader of the Green Party. He's shutting down nuclear plants. He's shutting down coal plants. And he wants Germany to stop buying any oil and gas from Russia. And that's because of his green ideology. Now, German industry is saying that if Habeck's policy is carried out, then the German auto sector will collapse. There'll be 1.5 to 2 million jobs lost. The machine tool sector will collapse. This is one of the great strengths of Germany, the intersection between machine tools and new technologies. So what Habeck is doing is playing a very dangerous game. But I think just to take one step back for a moment, the sanction policy, you mentioned before hypocrisy, the sanction policy itself is a hypocrisy. The idea that the West supposedly supports sovereignty and democracy, and yet if a country doesn't go along with it, they get crushed with sanctions under the so-called rules-based order. That's the hypocrisy there, and we see it in Germany in a big way. And there is a reaction developing in sections of the population, especially unionists, peace movement, the so-called left party, the Linke party, the so-called right party, the AfD. The real threat is that the Social Democrats, which used to be the peace party in Germany, has been completely submitted to the tyranny of the Greens and the Free Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we see the German situation heading toward over the cliff.
I'm not too sure where to start. I mean, I think it was actually Harley Schlanger in one previous program that you said that there are people in Germany that perhaps can't heat themselves because of the rise of energy costs. We have inflation that even the U.S. had a contraction that it reported negative 1.2% for its GDP contraction, which many are saying is going to perhaps lead to a recession. You have cooking oil that's being rationed in the U.K. The IMF has come out and issued a stern warning for the African continent that parts of it is going to probably have civil unrest because of lack of food. And I could keep going on and on. Of course, petrol and energy prices causing inflation in many countries. At what cost is this coming? I mean, is this a global conflict at this point, what we're looking at?
Yes, I would say that the conflict is occasionally taking place in Europe in a country called Ukraine, but in fact it's a global conflict. And it's a conflict that has been boiling down for quite a while. I mean, it's not something that started in February 2022. This is something that roots back, I would say, to the 70s. And then with different moments, it has popped out. But especially, we can say that it has been very, very visible in 2001, 2008, and now in 2022. So it's all linked. And the fact is that the hegemony that has been imposed by the United States in this multilateral, what they call the multilateral governance of the world, but in fact it's unilateral, masked by multilateral, this is no more sustainable. And they have to come to terms with themselves to accept that the world is larger, is much more complex than it was 50 years ago. And they have to open up in a sharing mood. But until when the United States doesn't make this process, we will face, all of us, a very, very worrying time with a lot of catastrophic consequences.
The rewards for Russia, Harley Schlanger, based on the report that has come out, is that it's going to have more income. It's going to rise sharply this year based on this report, $180 billion, despite the production cuts that have happened, and saying that one of the major attributes behind that is the rising oil prices, which will be 45% higher than last year. My question to you is, it doesn't seem like there's going to be a stop to the purchases made for Russian oil and gas. So isn't that a losing cause that the U.S. is leading and the EU supposedly is following, which it's really not, to say that they're going to try to suffocate Russia, at least in terms of its income?
Well, the whole thing is a losing cause. The problem that Europeans face is that the potential for trade with Russia is enormous, also with China. And they're cutting this off in order to support an intention of American and British bankers to sustain a collapsing financial system. And so the Europeans are essentially buying a sick horse here and trying to ride it. And it's not going to take them very far. You know, I think the deeper question here is that if you look at what Germany just did in terms of reversing its policy on arms shipments to Ukraine, it shows that Germany is still an occupied country for all intents and purposes. Its policies come from London and Wall Street. The foreign minister, Baerbock, basically is reading a script from Tony Blinken and from Liz Truss, the British foreign secretary. There's no independence in Europe. The Europeans are somewhat trapped in this fake illusion of a European Union, which is certainly what they might call a rules-based order, but rules that make no sense for the individual countries. And what I see is that the pressure on Russia is going to force more countries to pull back from trade with Europe. You see it already with countries like Nigeria, South Africa, Brazil are talking with Russia and China. India is doing a special transaction system to have the ruble and the rupee transferable. The Chinese are, or the Saudis are accepting the yuan for payment in oil. So we're moving to a new financial system. I don't think the dollar system is dead yet because the dollar system still plays a role and the Chinese would not want to see it disappear. But they're not going to give up their sovereignty for the sake of being in the good graces with Washington and London.
Thank you for that, Harley Schlanger, spokesman at La Ruche Organization, Potsdam, Germany. Paolo Raffone, Secretary General of the SIPPI Foundation from Brussels. Thank you. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tapley, it's goodbye until next time.